Welcome to the 14th episode of Transit, the podcast of migration history produced by the Department of Contemporary History at the University of Vienna. My name is Philipp Strobel, and together with my colleague Franziska Lamp-Michowiecki, we created this podcast to engage with experts in the field and to explore historical perspectives on migration, flight, and displacement. Today, I'm talking to Peter Cottrell. He is a professor emeritus in history at the University of Manchester. His current research is mainly focused on migration processes in Europe. His most recent book, entitled The Unsettling of Europe, The Great Migration, 1945 to Present, is a groundbreaking and comprehensive analysis of migration processes in Europe during the past 75 years. Peter, we are very pleased to have you here. Thank you very much for coming.
Well, it's a great pleasure. And I think this is an excellent initiative, and I'm very glad to be part of it.
Thank you very much. Let me just start with the first question. What are the benefits of studying refugee history? What can we learn by looking at history through the lens of refugee experiences?
I think this is partly a question about benefits, but also a question about purpose. Why do we do refugee history? And my own view is that, in the first instance, it's a way of enlarging the scope of historical inquiry. That is to say, as many people will appreciate, over the last decades, a great deal of attention has focused on questions around labor history, history of slavery, gender history, and so on and so forth. And I see refugee history as forming part of that process of enlarging the kind of subjects that are studied. But more specifically in relation to refugees, I think the issue is one of enabling refugees in the past to become more visible and to consider the actions that they take, their perspectives, their capabilities, to produce what one might call a history from below, but without, and I think this is important, without losing sight of the circumstances and the constraints, the difficulties that they encounter. That's to say, often the institutional arrangements that govern refugees and that might be devised to assist them, but nevertheless have the power to constrain them in certain sorts of ways. And so I think we can speak about a history from below, but there is also a history from above, and the two need to be kept in close alignment. The other reason I think we should study refugee history is to become aware of the fact that certainly in the 20th century, when one looks at the epoch-making events, whether it's World War, Civil War, revolution, state collapse, state formation, that refugees are integral to that history. They're not just marginal, but they're closely connected, closely associated with these events. And refugees can both be consequences of those events, but can also contribute. They can also be a causal element in bringing about certain sorts of upheavals. And then when you ask about refugee experiences, it's important, I think, that you've used the term in the plural, refugee experiences, rather than make an assumption that sometimes is made that there is some kind of uniform or singular experience. Whereas what we're looking at, I think, in the refugee history field is at plurality or multiple experiences. And here I think it's important to emphasize that one should be asking questions all the time about whose experience counts, or whose experience is thought to be important and by whom. And related to that, who speaks about their experiences and who is denied the opportunity to speak about their experiences. So whenever I think about the term experiences, always at the front of my mind is the question, who is given an opportunity and who is not given an opportunity to speak about their experiences.
Okay, thank you very much for your answer. In your book, The Unsettling of Europe, which I mentioned before, you mentioned that, quote, every major development in post-war Europe is connected to migration. Could you now pick one, just one significant event in European history and explain how migration played a role in it?
Well, of course, when you ask this question, it immediately occurs to me that there are major developments that probably aren't necessarily associated with migration. I have thought a bit about this in the view of one or two reviews, and I imagine it would be hard to associate, for example, the women's movement and the development of feminism after 1945 and relate that to migration. So it's probably important to recognize that there's a degree of exaggeration going on. But if I had to choose one event, I think it would have to be the great dislocations and upheavals associated with the collapse of communism in Eastern Central Europe after 1989 and through to 1991 and the dissolution of the Soviet Union, because here we've got convulsions that in some instances were extremely violent. I'm thinking obviously of the wars in former Yugoslavia in the 1990s. I'm also thinking of the fact that although barriers to restrictions on movement were torn down, that nevertheless, there are other instances in which new barriers were created or erected. What I tried to do in The Unsettling of Europe was to devote plenty of attention to these great upheavals without losing sight, if you like, of the kind of more micro elements that were happening in this region. The one example that I always found intriguing and in some ways significant was the situation in Russia in the late communist period, so the era of perestroika after 1986, that involved the history of Pontic Greeks. Now, the Pontic Greeks are not very well known, except to a number of specialists. But here we have a large number of people who had settled in what was the Russian Empire for generations in the 18th century and again in the 19th, and who lived more or less unhindered for generations, but who in the 1950s began to look for the opportunity to leave and did so in much greater numbers in the late 1980s and the 1990s. And the question was, well, who are we? Where do we go? And the answer, pretty obviously, was that we should go to Greece as a kind of homeland. So what this meant was that you had a resettlement process taking place in which Pontic Greeks found themselves often unwelcome in Greece. Who are you? What are you doing? You don't even speak Greek. You speak Russian. And now you're claiming some kind of affiliation to Greece. And this struck me as very significant, not because of the vast numbers involved, but because although minor in inverted commas, it nevertheless illuminated broader processes of dissolution and resettlement that were taking place across the continent at that moment in time, and how people who thought they might get a better deal elsewhere in what one might call their home instead found themselves being treated with a degree of hostility. And that, I think, was quite emblematic or symptomatic of what happened to a lot of people.
Thank you very much. In the making of The Modern Refugee, which was also written by you, you explore the connection between the end of colonial empires and population displacement. Could you talk a little bit more about this link and give us an example where it becomes particularly visible?
This is an immensely important and complicated and difficult issue, but I think one could simplify it, if I might, by drawing attention to two dimensions. The first dimension is that of what one might call the national liberation struggle, or the campaigns and the struggles that colonized populations embarked upon as they tried to weaken and overturn colonial rule. And what that meant was, in many instances, a struggle that resulted in their displacement either by colonial authorities trying to neutralize liberation movements Or, of course, the often self-imposed exile of the leaders of liberation movements and their dependents to adjacent countries, or sometimes further afield to mobilize the campaign by ending up in the Soviet bloc, for example, in the 1950s or the 1960s. So the first element of this decolonization struggle was that you had population displacement that was sometimes a result of brutal repression by colonial regimes. So I'm thinking, for example, of Kenya under British rule in the 1950s. I'm thinking of Algeria somewhat later in the 1950s under French rule, and how people were incarcerated to weaken the liberation movement, prevent civilians from encountering militant liberation freedom fighters. But I think it's also important to emphasize that this displacement or exile had profound and lasting effects on the people who were involved. You know, they were often in exile for years or even decades as they tried to wrest control from the colonial power. So that's the first element, the national liberation movement. The second, of course, is when colonial rule collapsed. What happened then was that you had what has come to be called return migration. Whether that applies in the early aftermath of the Second World War to countries such as Italy, the Netherlands, one should probably also include Japan and the dissolution of the Japanese Empire in that list, and then subsequently Belgium, France, Britain, and in the 1970s, Portugal. And what happened there was that the whole colonial edifice began to crumble, and the forces that maintained it, whether they're settlers, officials, military personnel, and of course local people who also supported the colonial regime, there was nowhere else to go except to the colonial homeland, if you will. But of course, for many people, it was a place, whether it's Britain or the Netherlands or Portugal, a place they'd never been to, but which they thought was the best opportunity of survival, of making a place for themselves. But here too, they often faced a hostile welcome, if you like, a reception, partly because people in those countries asked, who on earth are you? And partly because people in those countries regarded them as emblem or symptomatic of colonial catastrophe or colonial defeat. So the idea of return is something of a misnomer, because you weren't returning or repatriating to somewhere that you were familiar with. You were going to a place that you regarded as a kind of bolt hole or sanctuary, but which provided often a very distressing welcome. And even worse, if you were part of the indigenous element that had supported the colonial regime, you think of the Arqui in France in particular, but earlier on the Moluccans in the Dutch East Indies. So it was particularly difficult for them.
Thank you. You've also done a lot of work on Russian history. With the current refugee crisis in Europe due to Russia's war against Ukraine, how do you think this particular movement of people will impact the future and also the future of historiographical research? And how does it relate to refugee movements we've seen in the past?
Well, I think there are very difficult questions to be asked here, partly about the kind of reaction or reception that states, particularly in Europe, have offered to people, particularly women and children, who have sought to escape and from the risks of war and have found at least temporary refuge in adjacent countries such as Poland and sometimes further afield in Germany or the United Kingdom, for example. And I think here there are questions about the sort of provision that's been made. Why, for example, did the British government immediately relax restrictions on entry and favour Ukrainian refugees in a way that hadn't happened in other instances? I think this in turn raises questions about the future prospects of people who have crossed borders. Specifically, under what circumstances or conditions will they repatriate to Ukraine? And this is a fundamental issue, of course, in 20th century refugee history. The circumstances that facilitate repatriation and what's at stake when people repatriate. What kind of reception might they get? After all, for some people, it was a question of survival. But for those who stayed behind, for whatever reason, they might say, as refugees return, well, it's all very well for you. You managed to get out of here. And we were particularly vulnerable to enemy action. But then, of course, in Ukraine's case, what has happened is that particularly men of military fighting age were never allowed to leave in the first place. So I think the case, as it gets written about, will have to take account of different motivations, different constraints, different circumstances. And that's partly about flight, but it's also about return and repatriation and how one can repair not just the physical damage, the material infrastructure and so forth, but questions of repair or reparation are also about repairing social relations between people who have fled or not fled and people indeed who take different sides in the conflict. And then you also ask about how it will affect future historiography. Well, this is a very interesting question because there's likely to be an abundance of material in the media, abundance of material because people are tracking refugees, they're interviewing refugees. So there's going to be a superfluity or certainly an abundance of material at the historian's disposal. But I think a particularly difficult aspect of that is likely to be how does one interrogate, if I could put it like that, refugees who've been caught up in this conflict without regarding them either as victims or as compounding their trauma by requiring them to recount their experiences. So I think there are kind of difficult questions, including ethical questions, that historians will have to face as they come to terms with the scale of this displacement and the stakes that were involved in it. And you ask about questions of refugee movements we've seen in the past. Well, I think all I can do there is to just re-emphasize the point that here we have probably more material at the disposal of the future historian than almost any other case I can think of, perhaps with the exception of the wars in former Yugoslavia in the 1990s. But I think certainly in Europe, there's going to be an immense amount of material to digest. So that's a kind of distinctive element of what we're seeing today. And of course, as we speak in 2024, there's no immediate sign of anything improving, you know, as it were, on the battlefield or in relation to people who've been displaced.
Thank you. You talked already about future challenges for historians, such as the abundance of sources or ethical questions. Based on your vast experience on refugee history, can you try to look into the future and give us a glimpse into the future of refugee history? What issues, what topics do you think will need more attention and where will we have to do more research on?
I'm always cautious about predicting the future. So with words of appropriate caution, let me try and answer this question. What I would like to see is a continued and perhaps even stronger commitment on the part of those of us who study refugee history to an interdisciplinary approach. I mean, this is a kind of conversation between disciplines that requires everyone to play their part. So if we're thinking about the disciplines that have helped to shape the field of refugee studies, then I would think of anthropology, political science, sociology, legal studies as well, but also emphasize that if this is to be a conversation, it has to be a two-way conversation in which those other disciplines take due account of what historians are doing and vice versa. I think added to that, what might be worth thinking about is to incorporate in that conversation the work of economic history. And I'm mentioning that partly because of the first half of my career was in economic history. And I think there's an awful lot of positive scope for historians of refugee movements to begin to think about the economic dimensions. I'm thinking about what happens to the assets of refugees, what happens to their income, earning potential or possibilities. I'm thinking of issues around capital loss, destruction of assets, and so on, and reconstruction. And I think that's a promising way forward. So that's one answer to the question. I think the other answer is to acknowledge that although one might assume that in certain areas, everything has been written that could be written about displacement during the First World War or displacement during the end of the Second World War, nothing could be further from the truth, that there is always room for more research to be done in those and other areas. If you think of the Second World War, for goodness sake, let's spend some time, those who have the requisite linguistic skills, looking at what happened in China in the 1930s and the 1940s, for example. There's a lot of new work being done on Greek refugees, but not quite so much, at least not that I'm aware of, in respect of Turkey, for example, in the 1920s, in the aftermath of the great population exchange that took place. And then I haven't even talked about sub-Saharan Africa, where the archives are just kind of terra incognita to me, but where the potential for doing great new work must be enormous. So I'm thinking also of extending the canvas, and I hope that will be a hallmark of what happens over the next generation or so. And then lastly, I think I would like to see more conversations taking place with other historiographies. If you think about developments have taken place over the last decade or two in relation to things like histories of emotion, histories of health, histories of the body, histories of disability, and of course, environmental history. I mean, I think these are areas in which there's an enormous scope for people in refugee history to begin to talk to and absorb and to have conversations with people working in this field. And then if I might just add on to that, one last thought, which is the possibility, which I myself have not explored, but which other people are beginning to do, which is the idea of co-production of history involving not just people in academic institutions, but refugees, refugee communities, refugee activists, building up the possibility of a kind of conversation and eventually a history that might be written by historians, but also by refugees who take on the mantle of becoming historians themselves.
Thank you very much. And thank you for the fascinating insights into your work and the outlook on what could be on the challenges we have to face as migration historians. And of course, thank you very much for speaking with us today.
Well, thank you so much for the invitation and for giving me the opportunity to reflect on these questions. And good luck, everybody.
That was our 14th episode of Transit. Thanks for listening. We hope you will join us again. And of course, if you enjoyed this episode, please feel free to share it with your friends and colleagues.